This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Happy birthday!
Happy anniversary!
Is it birthday or anniversary?
It's difficult to say. I mean, possibly neither. But it's a milestone.
We're 150 episodes old.
I know. Who'd have thought we'd get to 100? I did, actually. I thought this
and we've got balloons and, like, party hats, goodie bags.
We're in fancy dress.
Yeah, exactly.
We've both come as FDR, which is embarrassing.
Yeah, we're going to play, like, pass the parcel.
Yeah.
Pin the tail on the podcast.
Yeah, we're going to play Do I Look Like a Badger? Yeah,
exactly.
All our live shows.
All of the old hits. Can you believe it? It's 150 episodes and almost 3 years, basically.
Yes, yeah.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah, and we thought, I mean, it seems like no time since we were celebrating our 100th episode.
And we thought it's time for a bit of self-indulgence. Self-referential self-indulgence. Here we come. No, we're trying to do it in a non-self-indulgent way, or not too self-indulgent.
But that in mind, we do have a clip to play in, don't we, of the first ever episode.
We need to do a
episode.
Sort of flashback noise.
Yeah, Emma, can you drop some kind of a harp or woozy sound effect
woozy
to show
sound.
That we're transitioning back from the present day to episode one? Ed, hello.
Good to be with you, Jeff.
Do you really have nothing better to do than sit in my loft?
I kind of, you know, checked out all the options, and I'm afraid this was the best on offer. I think we should tell people about how we met there, Jeff.
Yes. Yeah,
like so any couple.
Let's do it. So Ed was on my radio show in the run-up to the 2015 election.
People said you even made me sound vaguely human, which I thought was a sort of massive achievement on your part.
That's what I specialise in, making people sound human.
I think we should talk to people about the environment we're in though, Jeff.
Yeah, so when I was thinking about this, that the world is going to wreck and ruin, and surely there is some positivity out there, I thought, I'm going to get in touch with Ed. And I went round your house. I went into one of your two kitchens.
Yeah, thanks for reminding me.
And we said, yeah, let's do a podcast where we talk to people with ideas. And then I told Ed that I had been given one of these Japanese toilets.
To be honest, that's why I agreed to do the podcast with you.
Can we do it in your house?
It was the Japanese toilet that did it.
But you haven't yet availed yourself
of
it.
Well, give me time. I've only been here 15 minutes, I think.
Now, here is the amazing thing to me. We are 150 episodes, almost 3 years in.
More than 10 million downloads.
And you still haven't availed yourself of that toilet.
Well, it malfunctioned for
a number of
years.
It was out
of
commission for a while. My son dropped the remote control into the toilet.
It doesn't have appropriate privacy, that's the thing.
What about if I just gave you keys to my house? Okay. Let you know, maybe one morning after
Park Run. Is it back in operation?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Now, we have a thing on the episode called Stuff where people send in emails. And I've gone back further than the first episode to your original email.
Oh, wow.
That you sent to a colleague of mine, Stuart Wood.
The Lord. Now
the
Lord.
Lord
Wood.
And it's the 17th of March, 2017, 13:50:10 seconds, GMT, just to be exact. Hi, Stuart. So I've had an idea kicking around in my head for a few months, and for my own sanity, I thought I'd ask the question, however ludicrous. Would Ed be interested in working on a podcast with me? I want to explore the new big centre-left ideas from around the world. I'd love to play the everyman, you've done that very well, and have Ed explain accessibly what's coming out of the think tanks, academia, and policy units. It's all very embryonic at the moment. I mean, Jeff, you are a visionary. You end the email by saying, I suspect this is preposterous, and if not, I'd love to talk. I mean, maybe preposterous, and you'd love to talk.
Look at the brass neck of me sending you an email.
No,
like
never mind
that,
the brass neck. I've got a massive reasons to be grateful. Never mind reasons to be cheerful to you.
It's been fun, hasn't it, so far?
It's been great fun, and I've learnt.
I can't believe you've saved that, and the beautiful thing is I'm looking at it, and it's printed out, and it looks very sort of dogged. It's ripped. Ed sellotaped it. You know, it's obviously got great sentimental value.
It's become a family heirloom.
Yes.
It's become a family heirloom. Well, look, we're not just going to be sort of saying, hasn't it been interesting? We're going to try to reflect a bit, aren't we, on what we've learned during these 150 episodes. And this is not a sort of, we're not writing our obituary here, are we?
No, not at all.
Roll on the next 150.
Yeah, here we are. And what's been interesting is we do this on a week-by-week basis.
Yeah, every week.
Yeah, but what I mean is there's no grand plan. There's no do this year.
Yeah.
We kind of do it one week to the next. But what's been interesting looking back over the episodes is there's very much themes that emerge.
Exactly. And the first theme was around how to fix democracy. And as we said in the first intro, there was a strong sense a year after the Brexit referendum that politics was broken, the country was divided. Early on, we looked at the potential power of votes at 16. And then in episode 20, both you and I were really sceptical on the way into this.
Yeah.
We had a revelation, didn't we?
We did. Alex, who used to work on the podcast, kept saying to us, oh, there's something called sortition. I think it's really interesting. And
we thought it was a terrible name.
I think we sort of basically mocked him for it.
Yeah.
Said he was a nerd.
Yeah.
It sounded
which
like
is pretty rich coming from me.
And me.
Yeah.
Said it sounded like something from Harry Potter.
Yeah.
But he said, no, there's a really good idea. And we did this episode, and it was like we'd been converted in the space of an hour or however long it was.
Sortition is the technical word in the English language for this Athenian model of democracy, whereby assemblies are created by drafting people by lot and inviting them to speak. It's more than an opinion poll. As a matter of fact, we use lottery and sortition already every day, but it's in the worst possible form, and we call it opinion polls. With an opinion poll, we make a random sample of people, and we ask them what they think when they don't think. And here are the ideas. We ask a random sample of people what they think after they had a chance to think. And this is happening in Ireland right now. I think Ireland is perhaps the most innovative democracy in the West right now. The past couple of years, Irish government has been bringing together random samples of citizens to come and talk not just on mundane matters, but really substantial, even constitutional matters. One of them was same-sex marriage a couple of years ago, and 100 people were brought together then. 33 were politicians, elected politicians. 66 were random citizens drafted by lot. And they came together for 14 months. They had to discuss a number of issues of the Irish constitution. The most controversial one was the same-sex marriage issue. And those people came together for a period of 14 months. They saw each other for one weekend every month. And they basically learned from each other, learn from the experts they could invite, and were able to make a recommendation to the Irish government about what to do with same-sex marriage. And their recommendation was that the constitution should be adapted. Now, that went into a referendum, and that was the first time in history that a constitutional change was brought about thanks to working with a random sample of citizens deliberating with each other.
I remember the thing that I was struck by when we did that first sortition episode was just by how reasonable and level-headed people are when they're given good information and just given time to thrash out a solution. Because if you remember, this was in the heat of Brexit. If you ever watched a vox pop of people on the television, it was also polarized and people didn't seem reasonable at all. And I was just amazed about hearing about these citizens assemblies.
I mean, I think you're right. And I think it's sort of, in a way, it's worth kind of marking the fact that one of the reasons for your motivation, I think, for the podcast was that think of any problem and there was somewhere around the world that was addressing it.
Yeah.
And here was Ireland on our doorstep, you know, and we weren't, no one was paying any attention to what was going on in Ireland. And it's worth saying that the equal marriage referendum, which I think was 2015, was then followed in 2018, so after we did the episode, by a referendum on abortion, which also began with the Citizens Assembly. And so I think, in a way, I think you're completely right. It highlighted a different way of doing things. And it was, I think it was part of sort of looking outwards to the solutions that existed. And sortition has been a sort of a running theme for us. We did, and part of the reason we're doing this episode is to sort of, because sometimes people will be latecomers to the podcast, and we can sort of highlight some episodes that might be worth listening to. And episode 99 was on the written constitution. It was a live show at the Underbelly, and the academic Jeff King was talking about how the idea of a constituent assembly could help establish a written constitution.
What I think it should be is a specially convened assembly, technically a constituent assembly, sometimes called a constitutional convention, which would be composed of people that would write the constitution and put it directly to the people for approval by referendum. Now,
the Irish didn't do that, but they have used a constituent as a deliberative processes in the last few years.
Indeed. So let me just distinguish between a citizens' assembly and a constituent assembly. Citizens' assemblies get together and deliberate about important issues, and then they have a report, and then that will go to the legislature, which will decide how to act on it. What I'm talking about is different. They would actually write it. And it would go straight to the people. They'd consult Parliament, but Parliament wouldn't have a veto power on this. The Constituent Assembly would be two-thirds directly elected and one-third appointed, a direct appointment of citizens chosen by sortition.
And you do see them like quite often now, you know, they crop up in the domestic news and more recently a number of Commons Select Committees established a Citizens Assembly on the climate crisis. That's due to report in the next few months. And a couple of months ago we spoke to Becky Willis, who is involved in organising the Climate Assembly, about what it was like seeing it actually take place.
When I walked into that hotel in Birmingham the first weekend and I saw 110 people there who were representative of the country as a whole, it was, you know, a real heart-stopping moment, because it's just incredible to see your own country sort of in miniature in one room, and to think that all those people are going to be helping you tackle, you know, the biggest challenge we face.
And what surprised you about it?
Not necessarily surprising, but the most striking thing for me is what a responsibility the participants feel that they have, and how seriously they take the process. And, you know, that really gives me faith in people's ability to you know, to think things through and to deliberate and to talk to each other and come up with sensible answers. It's just seeing that in practice is incredible.
We've been very keen on the podcast to present ideas and not to be sort of naysayers, but I think it's probably worth then us sort of reflecting a little bit on the sortition idea and its sort of strength and its challenges. I mean, I think its strength, as you said, is the kind of deliberation it produces. I think in the case of Ireland, I think it's definitely true on abortion and on equal marriage that the public were bolder than the politicians expected them to be. So in a way, it's a way of politicians sort of testing the water.
Right,
So that's important. I think here's a sort of question, though, which is, take the climate assembly issue. There aren't really any guarantees that the government's going to do it. I think in the Irish case, it was a big proposal of the manifesto, I think, of the governing party, and it was the kind of compromise that they came out with, I think, in relation to same-sex marriage and maybe in relation to abortion. And so it was, if you like, it was up in lights that they were saying, we're going to... Now, this, it wasn't a commitment of the government, of the UK government, it was an initiative of the select committees, and that, you know, that's good the select committees did this, and it had David Attenborough and all those things. I guess the question going forward is... Is there a way, it's a funny thing for me to say, or maybe it isn't, is there a way to make life harder for governments to ignore them?
Right.
I mean, I think that, well, at least that's one question.
Yeah.
You know, so we've got something called the Independent Climate Change Committee, which reports on the government's targets on climate change. And in a way, it was a way of sort of binding the hands of government. Not completely, because government can ignore the Climate Change Committee, but it's, you know, it's sort of harder to do. You're ignoring what the climate, you know, expert scientists are saying to you. And so I suppose that's where a bit the jury is out. And then I suppose the second question is...
The citizen's jury is out.
And then I suppose the second question is, in the UK, we haven't really tested the legitimacy question. So I suppose in the Irish case, it preceded a referendum, didn't it?
Right.
It was like a micro... I'm just thinking aloud, but it was a micro...
it was a sort of micro...
It laid the ground
microcosm
for, it, yeah.
for then the people in general to decide.
Yes.
Now, I don't think anyone... Britain is hastily wanting more referenda. but I suppose... So I suppose that's that. It's that kind of transmission belt question. But look, the other thing is to say is lots of local areas are doing their own climate assemblies. But anyway, we think it's an idea that's got a lot going for it.
Yeah, and you're hearing more and more about it. And I think we probably owe an apology to Alex, old researcher, for making fun of the suggestion.
Yeah.
And also Ed owes him many apologies for making fun of his shirts. So can I just say, if you will be able to hear that Ed and I are recording this outdoors. We've reunited. We're 2 metres apart. We've reunited for the 150th episode. Now, unfortunately, Sky News have got wind that we're doing it, and they've got the copter up, the helicopter. The chopper is above us, trying to get exclusive shots of us recording episode 150.
They were tracking your bike ride, weren't they?
Yes, yeah.
Weren't they, from Stoke Newington?
Yeah.
With sort of commentary by sort of Hugh Edwards. should we move on to the next area?
Yes.
And it's been interesting for us, I think, sort of casting our mind back and looking at the episodes. And the second area we wanted to highlight was big tech, because we've returned to this issue again and again.
And I will be the first to say, I think when we first talked about the podcast, I had it in my head that big tech would be providing us with solutions and ideas.
Right.
You know, I thought, the amount of data that's amassed, maybe good can come of it. And I've become sort of very unconvinced that will happen with the way that big tech is set up.
It's ever since we were having a conversation with your wife about the Orient Express or something, and then suddenly, weren't you having a conversation about the Orient Express in front of
we were sat on the sofa and an advert came on for the Orient Express and said, a programmer said, I'd love to go on the Orient Express. And then every time I looked at my phone, there was an advert for it. It was so weird.
Yeah, exactly. That made you a tad suspicious.
Just a little bit, yeah.
And our second episode talked about the issues of what we call platform monopolies in the light of Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London's decision to temporarily ban Uber in London in September 2017. And we asked tech academic and writer Nick Cernicek about his idea for a public sector alternative to tech companies like Uber.
So we can think of an alternative here, and I think the best sort of version of an alternative would be TfL developing their own
Transport for London,
the sort of local legislators for transport within London, basically building their own app, which would be enable drivers to use their app to have all the same sorts of services and efficiencies of the Uber app, but just owned and regulated by TfL itself.
Now, what does that actually mean? Does that mean, because it's not just Uber, there are lots of other companies, there's black cab drivers. Does that mean everybody would be on that platform? Or would it be, is the public sector, TfL, just providing a sort of a platform which anyone can go? Or is it like a competitor to Uber? How should we think about that idea?
So my ideal situation, without thinking about sort of the politics of this, would be that black cabs are on it, minicabs are on it, Uber's on it, whatever they want, they're all on it, subject to basic regulations.
Now, I have to be sort of honest with you. I think of all the areas that we've studied and talked about, this is the area where it's much easier to describe the problems and the dangers than it is to provide solutions. It just, I mean, you know, we're talking obviously during the pandemic, and we've seen Jeff Bezos's wealth got by sort of $80 billion or some unbelievable amount of money. And it's just really hard, this, to work out. And, you know, we've been talking about the Facebook ad boycott in recent weeks. It's really hard to know where the solutions lie in this, isn't it?
It is, and we hear some great ideas. I loved that idea, for example, that Transport for London or any kind of metropolitan transport government organization could own the infrastructure on which all the tech companies operated. I really like that as an idea, but so often with this,
we will hear from people with great ideas, you know, open source or cooperative ways of doing things. But it feels too, I mean, I was going to say it feels too David and Goliath, but David did okay in that scenario, doesn't it? Yeah. But you need the governments to break up and curb the powers of these companies or open them up in some way.
You need something systemic. And to give a little sneak preview, we had a fascinating conversation which will be aired over August with Wendy Liu and her book Abolish Silicon Valley. And in a way, I think Wendy Liu she recounts her experience of Silicon Valley, but also, you know, the real challenge, I think the challenges of doing something different.
But I was really struck in that episode that we just heard from when we talked about how the analogies with the phone companies in America 100 or more years ago, or even the railroads, how those are examples of private companies, you know, getting too big and then the state coming in and opening up for the infrastructure and that stuff about the research and development. Wasn't it like 20% of AT&T, I think, had to go to research and development, and any idea that came out of it, the patents, had to be open to the public. And then all this innovation came out of that.
You're such a policy wonk. You were with your humble email of March 2017. You're out wonking me here. You sort of led us kind of helpfully into some of the other things we did on big tech. We did a really interesting interview with Shoshana Zuboff in episode 28, and she then produced a very, very renowned book. It's slightly the kind of Stephen Hawking book of the kind of tech sector, you know, the age of surveillance capitalism. And we were sort of slightly ahead of that. We did an episode on protecting children from tech. And then when Elizabeth Warren was running for the Democratic nomination, we explored what her ideas would mean. And in episode 79, we asked Sally Hubbard from the Open Markets Institute in the US about the way she would approach breaking up the power of tech monopolies.
I would look at some of the anti-competitive mergers that were mistakenly allowed and start to unwind them. Things like Facebook's acquisition of Instagram or Google's acquisition of DoubleClick. I would do a whole sector inquiry into the tech sector, which the FTC has started. But I would make sure that we had an entire huge team of technologists that could not just understand the anti-competitive behavior of the past, but the anti-competitive behavior of the future. A big part of the problem is that, as I like to say, these tech platforms, they are controlling the game and they're playing the game too. Right? No one wants to compete against a company that is controlling the rules of the competition. And that's what's happening with all of these platforms. So the idea is you have to choose, you know, Amazon, are you going to be a marketplace or are you going to be a seller on the marketplace?
I mean, it's interesting this because it's very appropriate time-wise, because earlier this week, the four big tech companies all gave testimony to Congress, and Jeff Bezos was being asked precisely about this question of, you know, cross-selling. So, you know, maybe you've been on, well, we've both been on a journey on all of the episodes, but maybe on tech, it'd be interesting to hear where do you sort of end up now compared to where you were?
I think I didn't realize my own privilege when it came to tech and data in some respects. I think, you know, I remember saying on an episode, oh, I don't care as long as I can just use all this stuff. Like if the price I pay is my data, then, you know, I don't care because I'm getting to use a good end product. And, you know, having these conversations and finding out more made me think about what a privileged position that is to be in, and you know, what tech companies and potentially governments having access to your data means for different types of people and how dangerous that is and how it needs curtailing. So that's one way I've definitely changed my opinion.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I suppose the way I think about it is, you know, we've done enough episodes that suggest that technology can be used for good purposes.
Undoubtedly, yeah.
We're not in the sort of, well, we should just sort of smash it all up or sort of get rid of it all. But it's got to be shaped. I mean, you've got to have government. And there is this libertarian streak among a lot of technologists, isn't there?
Yeah.
Which is kind of a problem. And in a sense, I suppose we know much more what a problem it is now than we did then because of Cambridge Analytica, what happened in the 2016 presidential election, the far right. The problems are much more apparent.
Yes, they are. And I think maybe even the attitude, not necessarily with the billionaires who own these companies, but maybe even with the people working in them and writing about them is beginning to change.
And maybe the answer is, to the extent that we've got one, and we've got to be honest about, you know, whether when we've got answers and don't have answers, is you need action on multiple fronts. You need to tackle the anti-competitive practices, you need better regulation around things like hate speech and so on, and you need to think about how data is owned and rights to portability of data, which is really important.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, for our next theme, we could start it by talking about one of our great lads' holidays that we've done. Because we've done a couple, yeah. Haven't we? We went to Austria.
Yes, Czernohorsky.
Jürgen Czernohorsky.
Yes.
Who had one of the most impressive offices.
And names.
That I've ever been.
Twitter handle, yeah.
But I think the greatest trip that we've done is when we went on our lads' holiday to Iceland.
You don't think you're going to get the video released by sort of buttering me out?
I think the public need to see it.
I really think the public do not need to see it.
We recorded.
I mean, there's many things the public don't need to see, and this is one of them. This is high up the list.
We recorded a lot of footage of me and Ed in a hot tub.
Yeah,
and
it wasn't a hot tub, was it?
Geothermal spa. Yeah, yeah. But
it was the sort of belching noises that came from the geothermal spa.
I'm not sure they were coming from the geothermal spa.
Pièce de résistance.
But it was a wonderful moment.
And it produced Reasons to be Icelandic, didn't it?
Has been one of our favourite episodes. And it's on one of the themes that when we look across the 150 episodes, it's very much on one of the themes that keeps coming up again and again, which is how do we promote gender equality?
Oh, and we got in there early, didn't we, with episode 3. We looked at the gender pay gap with MP Jess Phillips and Victoria Budson from the Women and Public Policy Program at Harvard. And actually, I was very keen to do that episode because it was about an experiment in Boston, which we need to kind of follow up, actually, to see how it's going, which was, I think I'm right in saying that it was banning employers from asking about previous salaries when they were hiring new employees, because that was finding a sort of ratchet down effect.
That's right.
Among women in particular. So if women started off on lower salaries, it kind of then cascaded through. So maybe that's something for us to follow up. We've since returned to the gender divide in the jobs that people do, episode 39, gender equality in sport, episode 94, positive masculinity, episode 127, ideas around shared paternity leave. We love father's leave, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, as in use it or lose it, father's leave as a way to change the workplace and family responsibilities, and universal childcare, episode 105. But we wanted to highlight, didn't we, the Iceland trip, and not for the geothermal pools.
No, special though that was. I mean, we were just hugely impressed by everybody we talked to, but especially friend of the pod now, I think it's safe to say. She filled in for me didn't she, when I had some kind of emergency.
Yes, she did. Katrin Jakobsdottir, and we asked why Iceland has topped the Global Gender Gap Index, i.e. most gender equal, for 11 years running. And the UK is only 21st.
Probably the reason for us being number one is that every time we see that list, we say, why is that happening? Because we never cease to fight for more gender equality. And we haven't reached the status that we can call Iceland a paradise for gender equality. But we're doing some things right. And I think, I was born in 1976. So the year before that, we had a famous women's strike in Iceland. Women walked out from their workplaces. I think it was around 2 p.m. And they said, we're not getting paid, for more work. So we're just going to leave our offices now. And it was a huge event. Everybody participated. In the years after that, we had all women's party running both for local communities and for parliament, and that changed everything in the other parties. So we have like a 40 years of history of women really campaigning in Iceland, still campaigning for women's rights, making enormous systematic changes that have actually made it possible, for example, for me to be in politics. I have three sons. I wouldn't have wanted to have to choose between having children and being a politician. And you would have to choose, you know, maybe you could do this if you were a very privileged person with a lot of people you could hire to do this for you, but I'm not. So without universal childcare, and, you know, all my sons have gone to the kindergarten at the age of 18 months or so, and the shared maternity and paternal leave. So me and my husband have actually shared the responsibilities for having those children. I wouldn't be here, definitely not.
And I think what's really interesting, listening to that again, isn't that these Nordic countries are just inherently better at this stuff. It's that the strength of the women's movements and the women's strike that Katrina mentioned there, it pushes it up the agenda.
I think at this point we should probably also just make a side note of how sort of brilliant our early conversation with Jacinda Ardern was as well.
Yeah.
Because we talked to her before. I mean, I can't say before she was famous, but she was Prime Minister of New Zealand. But before she'd achieved worldwide notoriety, don't you think?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she was just a sort of fantastic leader, clearly incredibly sort of visionary person. I think we sort of felt that then, didn't we?
Yeah, just brilliant. And we should mention, actually, that over the next few weeks, one of the episodes we've got coming out will be a conversation with former Australian Prime Minister Julia Gillard, who has spoken to a whole bunch of women leaders, including Jacinda Ardern and Theresa May, Hillary Clinton, and others about a book.
We're not talking to Theresa May, Hillary Clinton, and others, although they're welcome.
But about a book she's co-authored on women and women leaders and women in leadership.
It was a great. In fact, we had recently an email suggesting we do this, and she had just done the interview. But and I mentioned the episode on our interest in paternity leave. And I think of all the ideas on the podcast, this is one where it's really sort of sunk in a way it hadn't before, the way in which use it or lose it father's leave, i.e. leave that's allocated to the father, really could be transformative, both for the workplace and family responsibilities.
And society generally.
But I think people think about it as a sort of quite a narrow thing about, or not narrow, but an important thing about fathers bonding with their kids. It's about so much more than that.
Yeah.
It's about expectations of who does the childcare. It's about the workplace, you know, the Swedish, I think it's Swedish, isn't it? Latte papas.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, where do we get to on this? We've just reached 34% women MPs in Parliament. Now, that might sound better than it was, and it is better than it was, but I think it's worth saying Denmark, Norway, Finland, Iceland, Sweden have had that kind of representation for about 40 years. Mm-hmm. We're about where they were. And, you know, it's quite interesting. The more you look into it, the more you realise how behind we are. Shared parental leave, which is not use it or lose it leave, but the fact that mothers and fathers can share the allocated leave. Well, that was a policy again introduced in parts of Scandinavia in the 1970s, and they then concluded it wasn't working at different times, admittedly, and moved to a use it or lose it system. So, you know, we've got to change policy, we've got to change culture, but as you said, I think it's the social movements and the, you know, politics and the pressure is partly what drives the change.
So the Nordic countries, you know, are a progressive end of the spectrum. But how much do you think movement in a direction by countries which are our peers, Western European peers, how much do you think if policies start to change in those countries, that then has a knock-on effect in the UK? Because I can sometimes feel we're really parochial and don't
look. Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think that's, isn't that one of the things that we've learnt in this? It kind of relates back to what I said about the Irish Citizens' Assemblies, but you sort of feel like Scandinavia, and okay, Scandinavia has a certain sort of reputation, a certain history, but it can sort of operate in this, its own bubble. And we just say, well, that's not possible here, or it was just even, it's not even that people know about it and think we can't do that here. It's just, it feels like the Scandinavians have this tradition around gender equality, which was established early, and it's then sort of rippled through policy. And that's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, a more gender equal cabinet, parliament, and so on does change policy.
It's a slow ripple, though.
And the other area that we really wanted to discuss, and it has featured a lot on the podcast, is around the climate crisis. It's arguably the biggest shift in the political conversation since we started. We did a number of episodes on climate early on, including talking to architect of the Paris Agreement, Christiana Figueres, and then a series of events around the end of 2018, start 2019, pushed climate up the agenda. The UN report saying there was a decade to really stop irreversible climate change in October 2018, Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez and the Green New Deal, the rise of Greta Thunberg and the school climate strikes in January, February 2019, and then Extinction Rebellion around April of the same year, of last year. I mean, I do think it's this kind of race against time, to use a cliche, and I sort of feel like the science is moving so quickly. But at the same time, the movement is moving as well. And in February 2019, we went down to the school climate strike in Parliament Square and asked the young people why they were there.
Tell us why you're here today.
Because this is such an urgent issue that I think that the government really needs to kind of actually address, because they can make promises, they can go to the Paris Climate Accord, they can say we'll do this, but then we see no actual change. They need to make a change, and they need to do it now while we have the time, because there will not be time in the future for this.
I think this is our chance, this is the students' chance to show off that what really matters. And climate change is something that we, the younger generation, have to deal with instead of the older generation.
Can we please get a picture?
Of course. Yes, we are, Bob, and I like your sign.
Thank you.
So I thought we would come into this demonstration, this protest, because Ed believes the children are our future and he cares deeply about what the planet will look like for them in 10, 20, 30 years' time. In actual fact, it looks like he's here because he's being millimobbed. There's levels of milli fandom that we haven't previously seen. It's like Beatlemania, but it's Edmania.
You were in your element being asked for all those selfies.
I mean, I can't think who decided to put that clip in.
It is one of the
I mean, honestly, I argued with Joel so, like, hard to take that clip out, you know.
It is one of the most endearing things about you, how much you enjoy people asking you for a selfie. And, you know, when I'm with you and that happens.
Endearing, is it? I mean, I do think that the stories people tell you and the things people say to you can really, you know, they really sort of stick with you. And actually, I think if you can, like, listen to people's stories, maybe that's the thing.
Also, it's made me very familiar with a facial expression that I hadn't really encountered before, which is when you say to people who ask you for a selfie, "Do you want Jeff to be in it as well?" Because they want to be polite and not hurt my feelings, but look, but they don't want me to be in the selfie.
No, but there have been notable people on this podcast. I mean, David Runciman is one of the people who springs to mind, who have gone weak at the knees about being interviewed, not by me, but interviewed by you.
To the extent that he cropped you out of the selfie that the three of us took.
Is that right?
I don't know, probably.
Oh, probably.
That's what I have to live with whenever we do a live show. Speaking of live shows, a show we did last year, we spoke to climate lawyer turned Extinction Rebellion activist Farhana Yamin. And she echoes the experience of lots of people in the climate movement who joined Extinction Rebellion because they felt politics wasn't working on climate. And we're going to play a clip of her talking about why her experience of representing small island states like the Marshall Islands at the Copenhagen climate talks in 2009 eventually led her to join Extinction Rebellion.
So even back then, all of these countries were screaming and shouting about the existential threat to them, to their cultures, to their people, because they were experiencing it already, and they were very, very concerned. And we basically have taken a decade to hear them. And I've joined Extinction Rebellion because, you know, they were a very active movement in sounding the alarm bell much more loudly and clearly. It's not that we weren't doing that before. You know, we were churning out report after report. The scientists were arguing. But I feel that the politicians and everyday citizens weren't really listening enough. So you had to sort of do something quite kind of crazy.
And you glued yourself to the Shell building. I think we've got a picture of you. That's you. We're glued to the pavement.
Thank you.
See, what I took away from that conversation was that she chastised me for eating Alfonso mangoes.
Was that we brought them as a prop, did we?
I think so, yeah. We were talking about the environmental impact of my favourite mango.
I think, you know, it is really interesting about Fahana because it's just sort of what you might say the inside approach and the outside approach. You know, she's been a sort of insider, but for the outsider countries. And I think she decided, you know, to try the outside approach as well. And I think it sums up in a way the maybe quite a lot about this podcast, which is how does change happen? It partly happens from outside pressure and it partly happens from inside action. But, you know, it's the two have to go together. And look, we've covered a lot on climate, how we need to reach net zero emissions from shifting to renewable energy, episode 52, to planting more trees, tree distribution, episode 97, changing the way we use land, episode 130, how we travel, including more cycling, episode 84, and walking, episode 125, and then very recently with Chris Boardman and Jeanette Sadiq Khan. We also, and this is another maybe our scandophilia, We talked to Christina Bu from Norway's Electric Vehicle Association about why Norway does so much better than the UK on electric car sales. And it is extraordinary. I think it's something like 50% of market share.
It's unbelievable.
Against 3% in the UK. And we asked Christina on episode 93 why.
First of all, I want to stress that Norwegians are not very different from, you know, other European inhabitants, really. We are not more environmentally friendly or more, that's not the case. What is really the difference here is that we've had politicians that have been working and been willing to make the necessary measures or introduce the necessary measures to make this happen. And it is really very simple. In UK, in Germany, in most other European countries, or all really, buying an electric car is still a lot more expensive than buying an petrol diesel engine car, or an ICE car, internal combustion engine car. And in Norway, it's more or less same price. And how did we do this? Well, we tax the purchase of cars. So buying a car that pollutes costs a lot of money, and we don't tax electric cars. So we tax what we don't want and we promote what we want. And that is working.
So sometimes when we do episodes on the climate crisis, I'll feel really dispirited about the science and how slowly things are moving. But just as we've been looking at the various conversations we've had across these 150 episodes, what's incredible to me is I feel like even when we're not doing an episode on that subject, there's so often an environmental component to an idea. It's something that factors into, I would say, almost 75% of the conversations that we have. And
because they're sort of encourage a low carbon.
Yeah, exactly. World. Yeah, there's some way in which they're adjacent or they share those goals or those goals have been thought about. And I think that can, without being Pollyanna-ish, that can be really encouraging.
I do think one really important theme which we have tried to explore, and I've said it a lot as a over the years, is you know, I make this maybe joke, which is that, you know, Martin Luther King didn't say I have a nightmare, he said I have a dream. And I think we've tried to reflect, you know, that positivity.
About what the Green New Deal is, it's exactly that.
And it's sort of economic justice. And you know, someone from Extinction Rebellion said to me, you know, when I was talking about this, they said, what you're saying is that the environmental movement's got to become a working class movement. And I was kind of saying, well, I guess yes. You know, it's this sort of, you know, I think it's partly what inspires people, but it's also, and it's not to say there isn't, you know, room for an importance of sacrifice, but it is trying to say, if we're not about creating better lives for people, we're not going to win. But it can be about better lives for people, you know, walking and cycling. You know, we heard that recent episode with Jeanette and Chris. You know, healthier eating, planting trees. We've learned the importance of green space during coronavirus. I think all of that is really, I think, really, really powerful and really important.
You know, as important it is to
give a platform to these ideas and find out what people are working on. Something we've always been keen to do, I think, is talk about how change happens, how we get from talking about these ideas to seeing them in action. And we've been keen to look at what movements, strategies, organisations can help bring about change. Do you remember early on I was visiting my in-laws in Chicago?
The Fatcha Lot.
Yeah.
That's not your in-laws.
No, it's my brother-in-law's food truck. Yeah. And in between going and getting sandwiches from his food truck, I managed to go and talk about community organising.
Yes.
With somebody who'd worked with Obama in his early days as an organizer.
Exactly.
Yeah. And since then, we've looked at trade unions, which you can find in episode 14, The Power of Protest, episode 60, divestment, which has become a much bigger issue since
Definitely.
We talked about in episode 77, single issue campaigns, 86, direct action, episode 108.
And just to mention single issue campaigns, you know, I just, it really springs to mind Gina Martin and her campaign on upskirting.
Yeah, yeah.
Against upskirting and to have a law on upskirting. You know, that was somebody who wasn't involved in politics, had a sort of something happen to them.
Yeah.
And she got really sort of engaged in these in these issues. And similarly, Matt Zarb about gambling.
Gambling, yeah, yeah. Back to the episode on community organising. It was Jerry Kelman who I spoke to. Jerry Kelman from the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. And I talked to him about what community organising involves in practice and the ideas of Saul Alinsky, who was one of the early figures behind it.
So first and most fundamental tool of organising is to talk to people one-on-ones. So in a given day, I would talk to 10 people. And in that process, learn about the area from their perspective, but also begin to form a relationship and begin to get a sense about what it might take to get this person to take a step forward in a different kind of way. We might not tackle a root cause right away. We might try to go slowly, but eventually we're looking at the root causes. Why does it happen? Not how do we treat the symptoms of it?
And there's a lot of history of community organizing here in Chicago. It's the birthplace, really, of that in America.
It is. It is. And that's because Alinsky was mentored by John L. Lewis, who was one of the significant labor leaders in the United States. And his thing was to build coalitions. So Alinsky's language would be self-interest. I tend not to use self-interest these days. I talk about what it takes for people to change their lives. And I say, if you can initiate relationships based on mutuality, you can change your life.
And, you know, after the 2015 election, I went and did some course in community organizing, as you know, which led to a campaign in my constituency against Bright House, the manufacturer of white goods or seller of white goods at vastly inflated prices. And, of course, this whole issue of movements and how change happens has kind of come into sharp focus with the rise of Black Lives Matter over the last few months. And it's shown the power, again, of mass movements. And this June, we asked lawyer Matthew Ryder how important this kind of activism can be in bringing about change. And this was episode 142.
It's extremely powerful. I think it doesn't happen without a level of activism outside. And that happens in two ways. And for people listening in, they can understand that their activism can really contribute. The first way is to support those community organizations that are being active. I can tell you from personal experience that when you have community groups or small organizations that are working on these issues, when they are lobbying those in political positions of power and they have access to those in positions of power, it makes a massive difference to the conversation that takes place in the room. It's huge. And having the right people in positions of power, you know, Sadiq Khan's administration, whoever it is, you know, making sure that you have people who understand these issues is really important. And seeing young people on the street of all ethnicities saying, we want to do something about the lives of black people in this context of policing is immensely powerful. It means that those who have that intention in politics already have the wind behind their wings and they can say, this is really important. Look what's happening in the street. And those who are skeptical about it and say, no, the public isn't interested in that, are faced with a huge amount of people saying, we actually are. Black lives matter to us. So I think it's enormously powerful, and the kind of activism you're seeing now makes a massive, massive difference.
Yeah, something we've talked about, you know, increasingly over the last 6 months is that making the case for big ideas and big changes really hard. And what an important role movements and campaign groups have to play in shifting the national zeitgeist, especially when you're this far out from a general election and you've got a government with a majority. These types of campaigns can really shift the conversation.
And you know, even thinking about the change in conversation between our episode on Empire and episode 102, and we should give a real shout out to that. To that episode with Gurminder Bambra, because it really sort of opened my eyes. You know, it was sort of, we had this hunch, didn't we, that we weren't taught about Empire when we'd been
it was shocking.
In schools, and then I think we did a show of hands.
Yeah, we did,
and this just sea of hands went up saying no, they hadn't been.
It was unbelievable. We've had some quite special moments at the live shows, I think, but that's one that just really sticks.
And also
sticks
that we only
mind.
Paid off the national debt for bailing out the slave owners, which was 40% of our national income in 2015.
Yeah, I know. It was shocking.
And maybe the sort of what happened in the 2019 general election has sort of reminded us, demonstrated to us, and we've got more engaged in it, I think, that part of our job as a podcast isn't just to present ideas, but how do you create the circumstances in which those ideas are going to
grow and thrive.
Are going to grow and thrive and succeed.
And I suppose if you look at how much the Black Lives Matter movement, out of a terrible situation, has shaped and changed the conversation in just the past few months, it shows that these movements, you know, people are...
It's more popular than Donald Trump now in America.
The
Black Lives Matter movement, yeah, significantly more popular, which tells you something. And you see the change happening.
Yeah.
I suppose we should also say it's been really hard to choose these themes. I mean, you know, economic inequality has been another big theme of ours, and we could have selected lots and lots of episodes, and we'd encourage people to go and look at the back catalogue of issues, because that's been a really important theme. I think we should probably talk about the most important group around
the Beatles.
Our podcast. No, our listeners. I mean, one thing I want to flag up, because this was very important to us, is people don't have any doubt about where we're both coming from politically, but we try to make this as open as possible for people who aren't of a particular political persuasion. And I do think that's important. And, you know, sometimes people email us saying, you know, I haven't traditionally been of the left, or I haven't traditionally been a Labour voter, or whatever it is. And I'm really keen on that. You know, I
I think it was really important to us from the off to some extent divorce the ideas from any, let the ideas stand on their own merits.
We did a bit of a shout out, I think, on Twitter and Facebook about episodes people really liked. Lots of people talked about episode 50 from Edinburgh with Karen McCluskey, talking about her work tackling gang violence in Scotland. I think was a great episode. Another live show, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think we both teared up on stage listening to her talk about the work.
Well, it was an
did.
Extraordinary episode, because we had Karen, and then we should give a shout out to all the comedians we've had on and the cheerful people, but we then had Louisa O'Millan,
yes,
talking about her mother's terrible experience and her terrible experience with her mother's illness and some of the sort of, you know, some of the
issues around that,
some of the issues around the treatment that she'd got.
So that was one that came up a lot. Episode 37, Rethinking Economic Success, with Kate Raworth, who wrote Donut Economics, got a lot of mentions, which was, I think that was an episode that made us really think about what we value in the economy.
Yeah.
And it's something that we then came back to.
Including with Lord Gus O'Donnell, former cabinet secretary. People loved Reasons to Be Pirate, our bonus episode from April 2018. I'd really recommend that episode.
Yeah,
with Sam Conifiende.
Yeah, he was a power. Yeah, his book, Force of Nature.
Be More Pirate. And we've had lots of people flagged up the conversation with Katrin Jacobs-Dottier,
including Neil Oddie, who says, why can't Katrin Jacobs-Dottier be a permanent co-presenter? Do you think she's got time?
I don't know.
We should mention that over the next few weeks, you will hear these summer conversations. We've got some fantastic people lined up, as we've already mentioned. But also on the website and in our newsletter, which you must sign up for, we're going to try and curate some lists of episodes around themes, the kind of stuff we've been talking about today, and some other bits and pieces. So make sure you subscribe to the newsletter. Go to cheerfulpodcast.com.
And look, I didn't want the episode to end without a little sort of nice surprise. So
we sort of racked our brains as to who might be a nice surprise guest for you.
Uh-huh.
And we went for somebody who is, in some senses, a sort of global leader. She's admired, I think, around the world. She's played a special role in this podcast. Yes, it's your mother-in-law, Lynn Barron.
No. Oh, no.
Hello.
Hello.
Lynn Barron.
Yes? Who's calling? Someone with a funny accent?
It's Ed Miliband and your son-in-law, Jeff Lloyd.
Well, Ed and I are sitting. We're being very socially responsible. We're 2 metres apart. We're sitting in his back garden doing a retrospective, 150 episodes of Reasons to be Cheerful. And
we were trying to think of the most appropriate person who summarised the warmth, the vivaciousness, the dynamism, the compassion of the podcast, and I came up with you, Lynn.
I was thinking, who's he? Is this going to be Michelle?
Oh, aren't you guys the sweetest?
How are you coping with lockdown, Lynn, you and Joe?
Oh, we're doing great. We're not bored. I'm working from home. I'm loving working from home. I wear shorts and my clients can't tell.
You do the Zoom therapy, yeah?
It's going very well. And we're reading and walking and then staying inside. And there's a little boy in London I like to look at every day.
Oh, that's your grandchild, Jean.
Not me.
And then I listen to a couple of podcasts. Reasons to be Cheerful is always at the top of the list. By the way, the one on Facebook, do I get to say my two favorites?
Yeah, go on.
Yes, please, yeah.
Facebook was very, very interesting to me.
And what was the other one?
The transgender.
Ah, interesting.
That was a very moving episode, actually.
Definitely, definitely. And I'm glad, Lynn.
Very moving.
Talked to the father of a trans child, didn't we? And
yeah.
who is anonymous, but it was really interesting.
Sure.
And we'd really recommend people go back to and listen to that one. And Lynn, it's been great for me to get the chance to meet you. And you were a brilliant babysitter to my children. And you avoided them or me getting arrested by leaving them alone in the hotel room.
Remember, you were going to be arrested and you owe me big time, Ed, but you took me out for burgers.
I do.
Remember? And we have beers.
I do. I definitely. I owe you big time.
So, Lynn, are you saying the burgers and the beer weren't enough? He's still in your debt.
No, I owe her big time.
No, you also took me to the House of Commons.
It's true,
tea.
I did.
Ed, I owe you.
No. I definitely.
You guys, congratulations. I have something really important to say, that cheese and butter, where did you even think of that together?
It's so interesting, isn't it? It's such a big Atlantic divide. I mean, it's bigger than tomato. I mean,
two nations divided by a sandwich.
Know. You're not in favor of the butter on the cheese sandwich, Lynn.
No, and I love butter. I think butter is so delicious you don't mix it with anything.
Interesting.
Just bread and butter.
So what else are you doing on the show today for the 150th episode?
We've been sitting and we've been reminiscing and we've been playing clips and talking about the themes that have come up. But I did have a little thing for Ed, actually.
Oh, yeah.
If you want to stick around for this.
Yeah.
Now, this wasn't specifically for this episode, but Ed is a huge fan of the Boston Red Sox.
Yes.
And
I know
you talked a while ago about buying some memorabilia.
I think.
So then I was knocking around on one of these sports memorabilia sites, and I'm not a fan of any sports, let alone baseball. But I contacted one of these memorabilia sites in the States, and I said, I have a friend who is a Red Sox fan.
Yeah.
I'm guessing he sort of came of age as a fan in the 80s. That was where it really solidified. Said, if I wanted to get a signed baseball, I've got money to spend. Who is the most beloved Red Sox player of the 1980s? And this guy says, well, I mean, there is one, but it's a valuable thing to get a signed ball. So, you know, you're sure you want to spend the money? And I said, well, if it's a Red Sox player that is going to wow him, then sure. So I've got
oh
you a signed baseball.
Jeff.
Now the name means nothing to me, but maybe if I give it to you and then you...
I won't guess who it is in case it turns out not to be the person.
Why don't you try and guess? He says it's the one that all Red Sox fans in the 80s are going to be wowed by. And, you know, I think that's why he charged me a premium for it, really.
Well, that's incredibly nice. Is it Carl Yastrzemski?
It isn't, no. I'm just handing it. I'm handing it over to Ed now.
Bill Buckner,
is it?
Oh my God, Bill Buckner!
Like one of the greatest Red Sox players of all time.
But
right?
You know the Bill Buckner story.
What story?
Well, Bill Buckner was the guy that let the ball through his legs in 1986, leading him to total disaster. And he couldn't go back to poor guy, and he couldn't go back to Boston for a long time afterwards.
So he's not the most beloved.
No. But it's like fantastic. Thank you so much.
I knew that story. He crops up in an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is why I ended up getting it for you in the
first place. That is incredibly nice of you. Thank you.
Well, happy 150th.
Oh, that is so kind. And I haven't got your present.
Well, you got me the present of speaking to my mother-in-law on the phone.
Lynn, you're my equivalent of Bill Buckner, the Bill Buckner baseball for Jeff.
Oh, nobody said anything that nice since Sarah and I made up over our fight.
Let's not get into that.
Lynn, lovely to speak to you. Give our best to Joe.
Happy 150th.
Thank you.
Bye. Don't we love Lynn Barron?
Oh, she's great.
Well, look, here's to 150.
Here's to 150 more.
I want to be sort of serious for a minute. I sort of owe you a massive debt of gratitude. I really do. I mean, this podcast would never have happened without you suggesting it. And I'm really grateful to you.
We have a good time, don't we?
No, but I think it's really... I'm quite moved.
Well, I struggle with the compliment, so as you can see, I'm getting teary, so you've got to stop this, otherwise I'll start blubbing on the podcast.
And I think we sort of got to keep going, don't we?
I think so. The ideas are out there.
Yeah.
Got to fix the world.
And the world needs fixing.
It does.
Any other thoughts from you?
Well, we've got lots of people to thank, haven't we?
We do.
I mean, first and foremost, we should thank Emma, our producer, who is She's the third
come
point
out
of the triangle.
Of lockdown.
Yeah, it's the first time we've all seen each other in months and months and months.
And she was there at the foundation.
She was. I mean, we're the three surviving members of the original lineup who were here every week.
Actually.
So there's that. And speaking of that, we should thank Lindsay, who sort of runs your life and finds you time. Yes. To do the podcast every week, and our first researcher Alex Feist-Bryce,
definitely
who has moved on to
bigger and better.
Well, yeah, slightly sticks in the throat saying it, but he's doing all right for himself, that boy. And we were so lucky to find Joel Pierce,
definitely,
who came in after Alex started the podcast up. And Joel does an incredible job week in, week out with the episodes and all the research and finding the guests. Also thanks to Joe Kenyon, who provides so much backup for Joel. And Zoe Gelber, of course, who that newsletter we
definitely
mentioned every
we love
week,
the
it
newsletter.
Wouldn't happen without her. And if you think we've upped our social media game,
we have, because of Fanula DC.
That's right, it's not us, it's Fanula DC who's doing a great job with that. And then Gail's voice you hear every
week. Oh, Gail Lofthouse.
It was great when we had Gail on the live show in Sheffield.
We love Gail Lofthouse.
Yeah, and James Deacon made the little idents that you hear in between things.
Ed Seed
composed the music. I, you know, emailed a friend and said, do you know anybody who can make us a piece of music that is reminiscent of Ian Jury's Reasons to Be Cheerful, but in no way infringes on copyrights?
Yeah.
Ed Seed did exactly that. And Henry Cole. I mean, what artwork?
Well, Henry Cole. And also, we love Henry, but...
Let's not forget, for those, you know, early episodes every week, you would get great joy out of saying...
At least 100, yeah?
Yeah, at least 100. You would get great pleasure from saying...
Emily Power. I think we should thank Annabelle.
That's nice.
Annabelle Port, your co-presenter on Adrift. She's very non-proprietorial about you. She doesn't mind there being sort of three people in the podcast marriage.
No, she doesn't mind that I refer to that chair as Ed's chair, not Annabelle's chair.
No, she's a lovely person. Yeah. I think we should thank your wife, Sarah Barron, for being so kind of hospitable, funny, intelligent, warm, encouraging, positive.
Some of those words I wouldn't necessarily use with relation to Sarah, but you know, if we're really going for it, then we should thank the dame, then, shouldn't we?
We should thank Justine as well.
Yes,
very encouraging.
Yes,
she's been very, very.
And your boys, who've been to so many other live shows, and they're just always so great, Sam and Daniel. But yeah, thank you to everyone who works on the podcast.
I think it's time for us to sign off.
It is in time-honored fashion.
He's been Ed Miliband.
He's been Jeff Lloyd.
And these have been
150
Reasons to be Cheerful.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hurry into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener Salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save.